What's up, everybody? Welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable. Today, we talk to Prince Philip of Serbia. He is an incredibly generous, kind family man and humanitarian, and just a good dude with a really interesting perspective of life. Born in America, educated in the UK, and now living back in Belgrade in Serbia. Took some time today to talk to us about why he is a Bitcoin advocate, how Bitcoin can solve so many of the world's problems. It is just really genuinely refreshing to hear from somebody that's properly educated, who has done the work, and is just such a humble human being. Guys, I think you're really going to enjoy this one. I certainly felt privileged to have some time and to get his perspective on Bitcoin, the state of the world. If you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling overworked, you feel like the goalposts and your goals are getting further and further away from you, please tune in. This is a very wide-ranging conversation that touches on a whole range of topical things, from politics to war to money and life generally. I hope you enjoy it. Drop a like, comment, let us know what you think, and I look forward to hearing your feedback on this one. What's up, everybody? Today we have the honor of being joined by Prince Philip of Serbia, and this is promising to be a great interview. I've watched a few interviews with Prince Philip, and he is here today to talk to us about his journey into Bitcoin. And welcome to the pod. How are you?
Not bad. How are you doing, Adam? It's good to be here.
You're joining us from Belgrade today. Is that right, in Serbia?
Yeah, correct. Correct. Serbia, sunny Serbia today. Sunny Belgrade.
I'm really interested to get your perspective. I mean, the fact that, you know, our paths are crossing to me is just testament to what Bitcoin is. It's this remarkable community that brings together people from extremely different circumstances and lives and parts of the world. I'm sitting in Cyprus, you're sitting in Serbia, you were educated in the US and raised in the UK and got such an interesting background. I want to start the interview by just, what leads someone like you to Bitcoin? What's your journey? How did you discover it?
It was not a straightforward journey. Firstly, I wasn't educated in the States. I was born in the States, but educated mainly in the UK. And in
Don't worry. I got it the wrong way around.
Left the US States when my parents separated when I was just under 2 years old. Went to Spain with my mother, and then moved to London with my father. So was educated in Spain and then UK. So yeah. European.
Yes, got it.
Really, yeah. Hence the accent, but the accent's not quite British. It's a little bit stuck in between some island in the middle Atlantic between the US and the UK. But anyway, Bitcoin, I first bought Bitcoin in 2017, but I first heard about Bitcoin around 2011 or 12. I think maybe the first time I heard about it was when Wikipedia stopped taking WikiLeaks stopped accepting Visa and MasterCard payments, and they were only accepting Bitcoin. And I was, you know, I followed WikiLeaks a little bit back then, but didn't really pay attention to Bitcoin. I just thought it's like most people just dismissed it as magic internet money, something silly, really. And then fast forward to about 2017, my best friend in London, I was living in London, working in legacy finance in an asset management firm in the city, in Mayfair. And my good friend just like one day called me or messaged me and was like, hey, do you know about Bitcoin? And I was like, well, yeah, I thought I did. And he says, yeah, buy some. It's a good time to buy. And this was the beginning of 2017 when it was just starting to take off again. And that was just after the halving in 2016. And I had no idea about any of this. So I just bought some. He taught me how to get some on Coinbase and he taught me how to put it onto a wallet. And I also got distracted by some other shit coins at the time. And next thing I know, I'm buying it. I'm learning about it, but not really paying too much attention to it. Then the bear market happened 2018. Wasn't really paying attention to it much, but I was buying it every now and then, but just not learning about it, just because I realized that I had a feeling back then that it was something special, something that was going to be some sort of, it had a good future, but really didn't realize it, didn't go into much detail. Then finally 2020 came around, and I think this is the same story for many people, that 2020 was a big eye-opener. a real realization of what's happening in the world. I was working in legacy finance at that point for, I think it was about 10 years at that point. And I thought I had it figured out how finance works and stuff. I was very wrong. One thing I wasn't really sure about was actually how money works, what it was all about. And so when 2020 happened, when COVID, the whole pandemic hit, I started questioning a lot of stuff. I saw the huge amount of stimulus being pumped in. I saw quantitative easing being ramped up again. I saw a lot of stuff happening. And I was like, that wasn't really making much sense. So then I looked at the Bitcoin I had, and I was like, well, this has a hard cap. This, you know, there's not going to be ever more than 21 million. And, you know, maybe I should study this more. And so I logged into Bitcoin Twitter. I had a Twitter account that was dormant from like 2010. I went back onto there and started following some accounts, and I started learning. I bought the Bitcoin Standard. And next thing I know, by the beginning of about 2021, I'm like properly orange pilled. Yeah. And I sold all my shit coins and went straight into Bitcoin. And I haven't really looked back since. Yeah, then the journey took me to, I was very private about it. I never really spoke about it openly. And until about March 2022, when I was on TV and in a talk show with my wife here in Belgrade. Oh yes, also in 2020, I moved to Belgrade to Serbia with my wife and my son. We left the UK. I'm happy with that. With leaving the UK at the time, we went to Serbia. Things are a little bit more open here back in 2020, and we. Yeah, so by 2022, I went public about it. And next thing I know, I was traveling the world and meeting people about Bitcoiners. And I got offered a job at Jan3 with Samson Mao. And here we are today.
That story almost models mine exactly. Like, it's in terms of the timing of your involvement, the number go up reason for investing, and then the journey of 2020 and then realizing actually this is much deeper than just a number go up investment, you know, and it's fascinating. That journey.
The old saying is, you know, you come for the make the money, but you stay for the revolution. That's very,
yes,
very well, tells my story.
So I find it really fascinating, you know, as somebody who produces content on the internet, I'm always fascinated by people who have massive opinions about Bitcoin who have very little education. Here I am talking to somebody who's from a royal family, educated in London at Canterbury, 10 years in professional finance, and you just said, I didn't understand money. And that to me is, it's so refreshing to hear that. And I hear it, I find him with Bitcoiners quite often. You know, Preston Pish, for example, has a company called Ego Death Capital. It really does, yes, humble us, you know, when we learn this stuff. So I'd love your unique perspective. I mean, doing what you do, you obviously do a lot of public service. You've been to a lot of war-torn parts of the world. You've seen a lot of the world. In fact, you were here in Cyprus. You were saying just before we rolled tape for a while, where I am recording today and now live in Cyprus. So you've had this unique perspective of being born in the US, educated in the UK, traveled through very war-torn parts of the world like Kosovo and Serbia and so on. How does Bitcoin fit in to that, you know, that view of the world where you've seen war and you've seen really unstable economies that an Australian or a New Zealander watching this might not have the similar perspective because they've lived in such a blessed, stable, calm place?
Right. So, yeah, the two regions, well, the region you mentioned, Serbia, has had its turbulent history, and not just because of war, but also economically. Serbia, well, Yugoslavia at the time, in the 90s, experienced the third worst ever case of hyperinflation. That serves as a big wake-up call to what is hyperinflation. And hyperinflation wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fiat system. You didn't get hyperinflation pre-fiat. So really, yeah, when you study it, you realize, well, what is hyperinflation? It's when people in power who have access to the central, that are in control of the central banks, and they have huge costs coming up, like war or failing economies or whatever issues that they have with their countries, then they will start to print money to pay for that. And that gets out of hand. Next thing you know, the currencies are completely over devalued by the second, and economies completely crash. And that's what happened in this country. On top of that, we also had one of the worst ever. I completely forgot the name. Sorry. What's happening to Russia right now when they have an economic... international restrictions. What do you call those?
Tariffs and
not tariffs. When right now we're during the beginning of the war, of the Russia war, they stopped trading with Russia because,
embargoes.
Anyway, people on the show right now are going to be thinking, what an idiot, right?
You know what? People on the show right now are going to think, this guy is real and I love it because it's not what people expect, you know, and I love that you're grappling with some of this stuff.
So what happens, you know the word, everyone knows the word. So in the 90s, because of Serbia's, I say Yugoslavia's, the fact that we were at war with each other and war with NATO, the West stopped doing economic trade with us, and that constricted us completely.
Sanctions.
Thank you very much. Yes, yeah, my brain was sanctioned for a second.
Economic sanctions,
and so that was also another bit of a wake, wake up that people here couldn't partake in the global markets, global in the trade, European markets, and so that turn made Yugoslavians quite resourceful, and you still get the that feeling over here. But people here very much look out. I mean, they're very welcoming, open people. Us Serbs, we are very hospitable and stuff. But when it comes to survival, we know we have that grained in, especially after all the wars that we've been through. That it's about taking care of number one. So you go to the markets here, you go to the local market here, and people have ways of accessing products that you can find in the shops, but you can find it much cheaper. But because these people have found ways of getting it from across the border. And they're not subject to the import tax, the duty taxes that most products are subject to. So there's always this way of survival over here, and I mean that is what Bitcoin is really. It's something that's not really sanctionable. You can't stop Bitcoin from happening. And I think people here, a lot of Serbs, a lot of Yugoslavians in general, understand what Bitcoin is. But that's why it's a very cash-oriented society. We are cash is king here. Our currency in Serbia is not the strongest, the dinar. What it's still sort of somewhat semi-pegged to the euro, but it's we're having issues with inflation here. The government here are printing a lot of money. There's a lot of devaluation, and we've had, like most of the world, most of the Western world, inflation has picked up again here, especially 2022. But every month, it's the same story. But what I was trying to get at is that people here they're very cash orientated, and they don't like to use cards too often. So when you go to the markets and you go to buy your food and stuff, most people go and use cash. And when they're trying to introduce credit cards or the fiscalization of transactions here, people will instantly stop that. In 2021, this is before it was public about Bitcoin over here, there was a big move by the state to try and fiscalize all transactions in the marketplace. And instantly Serbs almost, I mean, not created revolution, but they were up, hands up in the air, and there was like big resistance against that. And I was quite vocal against that. I didn't put forward the solution of Bitcoin at the time, but it just shows you that Serbs are very aware of the need of cash. And I think the next best thing after Bitcoin is something like cash. It's not perfect. It's still subject to inflation and controls, but it's better than transaction purely on credit cards. So people here are very aware of the issues of fiat and how weak it is. And I think most people still are one step away from fully understanding what Bitcoin is. And you still get a lot of resistance to wanting to understand Bitcoin. The people in Serbia, they see Bitcoin as something that's a bit too good to be true. You talked about like how people in Australia, New Zealand, they live in very high trust societies. Whereas in Serbia, it's a bit of a low trust society. There's not much, there's not much trust in the state here. And for obvious reasons, there's a lot of corruption. And you see it when you walk around Serbia, when you walk around the towns and stuff, you see it. Everything's a little bit rough around the edges. Like the pavements are a little falling up to pieces, the concrete's coming off their roads, potholes here and there. There's not much money being pumped back into keeping the place looking tidy and stuff. Society works perfectly well. Of course, there's issues. No society is perfect. But you can see it. It's crumbling here and there. And that's the case because there's a lot of money being whisked off on the side, and Serbs are aware of that. So the trust for the state is quite low here compared to places in the West or Australia, New Zealand. So when they see something like Bitcoin coming around, they instantly put up their defenses because of all the issues that they had with war, with NATO bombing them and everything. And they associate Bitcoin with something that's too good to be true, like something that's controlled by some CIA, Mossad, or MI6 and stuff. So without fully understanding what it is. So at first there's that distrust, but when people then learn about what it is and that the fact that it's completely decentralized, no one controls it, and it's consensus driven system, then they start to wake up.
You must have faced, I mean, I think all Bitcoiners face that coming out of the Bitcoin closet moment, right? Like when they go public with the fact, I'm a Bitcoiner, you know, yeah. It's kind of that same sort of reservation, right? So I think in your position, that must be times 100, right? You know, you come from probably a traditional family of traditional education and wealth mechanisms, and, you know, and now you're saying, Bitcoin is it. That did you struggle with that at all? Like, you know, embracing what you know many people misunderstand?
Yes. I mean, it was, as I said, it was not linear, my journey into understanding Bitcoin. There was points of realization, epiphanies. And when you understand Bitcoin a little bit more, and then maybe 2 weeks later you learn about something else about Bitcoin, and it starts, you know, another light bulb in your head goes off. There were moments, like I think one of the big moments was that solidified my understanding of Bitcoin. I solidified my understanding. We're still learning about Bitcoin. We just talked about this earlier on before the show started recording. It's like we're always constantly learning about Bitcoin. But what solidified the fact that I think Bitcoin is the one, it's the answer to a lot of the world's problem, was in 2021 when China tried to ban mining. And I understood what the difficulty adjustment was in Bitcoin. I thought that was a big proof of that Bitcoin is something indestructible, and it showed how its anti-fragility was something that's just going to do wonders for this world. The fact that China, one of the biggest powers, the second biggest power in the world, where it had 60% of the hash rate securing Bitcoin in China, and they took that offline, the majority of it, and most people unaware of what Bitcoin, uneducated about Bitcoin, would say, oh, that would kill Bitcoin. But no, that only made it stronger and more decentralized. That all that mining, that all that hashing power went offline. And what does Bitcoin do? Every 2 weeks, it adjusts itself. And it meant that those people that were priced out of mining because it was too expensive, because of the electricity cost, now it became cheaper for them to mine. So those people with those miners around the world were able to plug their machines back in, and it just instantly meant that the mining the hashing geography spread just instantly became more dense, decentralized, and spread across the world. And we had a bit of it proved that Bitcoin is like a beast with a head that you chop off, and then 10 other heads grow. It was a beautiful moment, and that's when I realized, okay, this is special.
I've said it's perhaps the most important invention, one of the most important inventions in the history of humanity, because money touches everybody every day, multiple times a day, from the moment you get up to the moment you go to bed, everything is about money. You know what you're going to do today, how you're going to do it. What, you know, when you go and exchange your time for money, how sound is that money? Like, is it going to be worth the same in a week, a year, 5 years? Like, money is intertwined and inseparable. And now we have for the first time this technology, which you described, like that, what do they call them, a kraken, like an octopus kind of thing, that is borderless. Yeah. And it ignores, it doesn't ignore governments, but governments, it can't control it because there is no centralization of it. It is global. When an entire nation like China bans it, no problem. The incentives move and the people move and it can't be weaponized. And that's, I guess, what I was digging at with when you go to these parts of the world. And I talked to Lawrence Lepard recently, and he said, you know, one of his favorite things about Bitcoin is you can't be used to fund wars, you know, and the governments can just pick a fight and then just print the money to go fight. And who's incentivized there? Who wins there? Well, this a small group of people do win.
This is the issue, what I was talking about before. What hyperinflation is quite often the result of war. And fiat, one is, I mean, we don't understand how fiat fully came about, what the incentive was about fiat coming into existence. But it certainly feels like a lot of it was about helping to fund wars. Because wars, before central banking, before the Federal Reserve was created, wars were a little, were much more concentrated, monarchical wars. So in the era of monarchies, wars were expensive. And in those days, pre-Federal Reserve, pre-proper central banking days, and in the era of when money was actually backed by something physical under the gold standard, it was expensive to partake in war, and they couldn't really print their way into buying more armory, guns, paying soldiers and so forth. So wars were concentrated. You could be living in a country in a war and you wouldn't even notice, because it was in a concentrated battlefield. And also wars are much more about a territorial dispute between one monarch and another. And if you ran out of money, that was it. Also have to point out that monarchs, then kings and queens, also had very bad credit ratings because of the wars that they partook in. So it was difficult for them to borrow money at good rates. But then something happened around the beginning of First World War where, you probably talked about this in your show before, just before in 1910, there was the secret meeting in Jekyll Island off the coast of... New York. It was in the South. Sorry. I'm firing a lot of blanks today.
I'm trying to think of it. Oh.
Anyway, there's an island that they had a secret meeting where you had a bunch of big financier bankers like J.P. Morgan, Rockefellers, Wahlberg Brothers, and people like that. And they had a secret meeting in 1910 that led to the creation of the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve was there. It was basically, their vision was that it was going to be the bank that would support all other banks and be the lender of last resort. So whenever there was any issues with banks and where they were failing because they were partaking in fractional reserve banking, the Federal Reserve would bail them out. But the thing is, this was never a federal setup. Initiative. It was never an initiative. It was a private setup, and they have essentially shareholders. So they ended up becoming incredibly powerful because they controlled the money. They were able to back everything. Yes, at the time it was still backed by gold, but it didn't stop them from printing more notes than there was gold available. And this is what happened right at the start of the First World War. 1913 was when the Federal Reserve was created. So the First World War, what started off as a monarchical war, ended up as a sort of full-blown democratic war. And then after the creation of the Federal Reserve, then that's when wars became much more widespread and all-encompassing, engulfing countries completely. And they were able to print massive amounts of money, create massive amounts of debt to create these guns, these horrible guns and war machines that destroyed countries, leveled cities and everything. And that was a story ever since the First World War. Then that led to the Second World War, and it led to America going into war after war, all funded because of the Federal Reserve, really. I mean, and other
the ability The ability to print money,
to partake in horrible endeavors like that.
And this is something I want the listeners to really understand, that the only proof of work network in the world is Bitcoin in the crypto universe, right? As far as I know, I don't think there's any among the tens of thousands of other cryptos. I saw you on the TV show where you stopped the host and you said, no, hang on, Bitcoin and crypto, two different things, right? 100% correct. So the world, when the world operated on a proof of work standard, meaning if you didn't have the physical gold, you couldn't buy the guns and pick the fight, right? So you think twice about starting a war when you don't have the gold, and you have to go and dig holes and prove, and the proof of work is the gold token in your hand, the physical gold.
Right.
When we, and that's what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin, you can't just go and print Bitcoin. You have to actually go and expend real world energy, which is getting more and more difficult to solve the problem. So you need more energy to mine more of the Bitcoin. So it's a proof of work network, meaning that it's honest. It can't be weaponized. You can't cheat. And there's no incentive to cheat, because if you did, you'd devalue the system. So it's very, very clever.
A lot of people who don't understand Bitcoin, they think it's just another digital, something digital, just like fiat is digital, but fiat is not tethered, it's not connected to the physical, to the world. It has no physics behind it, whereas you perfectly well explained that Bitcoin has the proof of work, has energy securing the network, and
real physics.
So that's why Bitcoin is actually tethered, attached to the real world in that sense. And that's why you can't game it. You can't override it.
It's a very powerful point. It's a very powerful point that you're making here, because it's the untethering from the physical real world that has caused millions, tens of millions of death, incalculable damage and to property and life.
Yeah, to physical damage, physical, but also economical damage as well. Mm-hmm. That the fact is that the current system, the current financial system, the fiat system, when you earn fiat that you earn, that you want to save in, is easily devalued by someone pushing strokes of a keyboard. Someone can devalue that with no work required. A centralized power, a central bank, a bank creating more debt out of thin air can devalue your hard-worked currency, your hard-worked money, with you having no control over it. That is incredibly immoral, unethical. Mm. And Bitcoin stops that.
Yeah, the rest of us have to actually prove our work to get paid at the end of the week. Right. We have to go to work, we have to punch in and punch out, and they pay us, right? And our proof of work is our actual life, whereas the banksters and the rest don't have to do that.
No, and that's what leads to issues like the Cantillon effect, the Cantillon effect, which was a French economist in the mid-1800s, in the mid-19th century, figured out that those closest to the central bank, and back then central banks were they were backed by gold. And this is where gold is also troublesome, because they were backed by gold, but they figured out that when people store their gold in a central bank, in a treasury, you in return they give you a note or receipt saying that this note or this receipt is worth X amount of gold, and you can always go back to the bank to reclaim your gold. The issue is that the people in control of the banks, what they realized was that not everyone comes back to claim their gold at the same time, so they're able to actually partake in fractional reserve banking, so they could actually create more receipts, more notes than there is actual gold. And that's what what led to the creation of fiat.
Do you have concerns about that happening with Wall Street now coming to Bitcoin with the ETFs and so on?
It's happened before in the past. It happened with just exchanges like FTX. Paper Bitcoin is a huge issue, and it's happening today as we speak. It's hard to track today. It was hard to track back in 2021, 2022 with FTX and the other exchanges that blew up, but it's definitely happened today. I mean, proof of reserve, when you're holding it in custodians, when it's very when it's Bitcoin, when it's difficult to prove that you'll be able to locate all the Bitcoin and prove that it's actually one to one.
for the listeners, what we're talking about here, custodians and things like that, I'm mindful of the people who have no context at all. When you buy an ETF, so let's say you go to your brokerage account and you buy some IBIT, which is BlackRock's ETF, you give them the money, they tell you you have X amount of Bitcoin, but how do you verify that, you know, that they actually did go to market and buy that Bitcoin and hold it in a custodial wallet for you?
But this is the thing about Bitcoin. It's actually when you buy Bitcoin in an exchange, the most important thing is to take it off that exchange and hold it in your wallet. And that wallet can be a very simple online wallet on your mobile phone, on your smartphone. And you then, when you know it's secured, is when there's a part in that wallet that says to secure your keys, your private keys. The phone, the wallet will give you 12 or 24 words, and you save those words, write them down, secure them, put them on metal, put on something indestructible, and you hide that. Once you've done that, then you know your funds are secured. Then you can take it to another level, which is actually taking it onto cold storage, so actually taking it offline. Cold meaning that it goes offline. That means that you get a hardware wallet, and there's same idea. Write down the keys, the 12 or 24 words, and you've taken it offline. And that means that you're completely secured in that no third party can actually access your Bitcoin, your coins. And that's the old saying, not your keys, not your coins. Because when it's held on an exchange and you haven't, the exchange means that they can do whatever they want with your Bitcoin. They can blow up, they can go bankrupt, they can walk away, and they can take your Bitcoin. So it's very important. That's what Adam was saying, that with the same ideas with ETFs. With ETFs, it's the same idea that you're buying just exposure. You're not actually buying the Bitcoin directly. You're just buying exposure to Bitcoin. And it's held in a custodian, in a big financial custodian like BlackRock or Vanguard or something like that. And you think, yeah, that's trustworthy. But big financial institutions can blow up easily as well. We saw that in 2008. We'll see that again in the future. And these guys will just walk away with your exposure to Bitcoin. So it's very important that you take your coins off the exchange and into your custody, self-custody. The issue with ETFs is that they don't really have that option yet. Some of them are now giving that option, but it proves that some of them won't want to do that because of the potential abilities for them to game the system and create more Bitcoin than there is. And that's what we talk about, paper Bitcoin. Paper Bitcoin is essentially us just saying that people pretending that companies, financial institutions selling Bitcoin, that's not actually Bitcoin. And this is exactly what happened with FTX. FTX blew up in 2022, and FTX grew into one of the biggest exchanges from when its existence in the late teens up until it blew up 2022. And they were selling a lot of Bitcoin, but actually they only had a few Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So when people wanted to take their Bitcoin off the exchange because the people started realizing that they were insolvent, that there wasn't enough Bitcoin to go around, far from it. So it's
as proof. Warren Buffett says, that when the tide goes out, we find out who's swimming naked.
Exactly. Exactly.
There was a lot of nudity going on over at FTX.
It will happen again in the future. You know, you'll never stop humans from being human. And humans are always incentivized to look out for themselves. And Bitcoin helps to correct that over the long run. But as we still live in a fiat financial system where the incentive structure is set up in a way that it actually rewards criminality and unethical and moral behavior. You know, that's why you get a lot of psychos running the place.
Yeah.
That's why if we move on to the Bitcoin standard, it helps to realign those incentives in the proper way and actually rewards hard work, and it actually rewards those who are fair, honest, and do things by the book.
My thesis on a reason to buy Bitcoin, and again, not financial advice, guys, you know, I never tell people to buy Bitcoin. I tell people to buy the Bitcoin standard. And then once you've read the Bitcoin standard, then you can make your own decision, because I think it's one of the best pieces of work out there. by Saif Dean and Moose. It's a book. You can get it. It costs you $10, costs you 10 hours to read it, and then you can make your own decision.
You can even download it off online. He actually says that you can download it PDF, and he's happy to do that because he knows that you're going to buy the book afterwards.
So read the Bitcoin Standard, and if you have a spiritual bent and you like the sound of anti-war money and, you know, that's in you as well, another great book to read is The Tao of Bitcoin. I tell most people to read that as well if you have that sort of side of you. But if you're just a hardcore capitalist and logical person, you know, read the Bitcoin Standard. But one of the reasons that I sort of, as an underlying use case for people to why I think we're still early in Bitcoin is that there's so many parts of the world where they don't have sound money, where these people, they don't have the same levels of compliance and trust, and people are just ripping off their populations. More and more people are starting to realize that we need a sound money. We need a money that can't be just printed at the will of a politician. Even in like Australia right now, we're going into an election. Essentially, we've put the money printer next to the people, right? The voters, because all the politicians do is say, if you vote for me, I'll give you all this stuff that we're just going to pay for by printing money and devaluing you. Like all your work, your houses are going to go up, your food's going to go up, your fuel's going to go up, everything's going to go up, but we won't tell you that. We're just going to deliver on these promises, print money, and that's how it's actually going to show up in a few years from now. So people are starting to wake up, and with the world at the moment, I sort of get this sense that there's like a real like sense of tension. It's because large populations that hadn't experienced what less fortunate parts of the world in Eastern Europe and so on have are now starting to feel it for the first time. I think a lot of Americans, a lot of Australians are starting to go, hang on a second, I feel like I'm working super hard here and I'm getting further and further behind.
Right.
Do you feel that's where we are?
That's what I was going to try and, when I went off on a tangent over there, is the Cantillon effect. This is what we're seeing today, is those are closer to the money printers. So the big institutions, the people who are close to the central banks, so people who have the best, who like rich, the rich, basically the rich, the powerful, the biggest companies, your big S&P 500 companies in the UK, the FTSE 100 companies, I don't know what it is in Australia, but those companies are able to borrow money at its cheapest. So if the interest rate is set at like say 2%, they're able to borrow money at 2%. So what happens when they borrow money to put to create money. When money is borrowed, it's actually created out of thin air. And they use that money to invest into the financial system, into the economies to boost growth. But what happens is a lot of that money then ends up as well into buying properties and the real assets. And this is why you get to see the price of houses exploded after the 2008 financial crisis, is when interest rates went to zero, is that those who were able to borrow as close to zero were then able to then realize that money is going to be devalued. So I'm going to park the money that I'm borrowing into property. And that's why property became a vehicle for saving money, which it shouldn't be. Property should just be priced at its utility value, plus maybe at a premium for its location, to schools, to transportation, and so forth, but not as an investment vehicle. And this is the issue. This is why people felt like they're falling behind, and it feels like they're getting further and further away from living a comfortable, sustainable life. And so, those further away from the money printer, those further down the food chain, are able to borrow money at worse and worse and worse rates, to the point where the average person is getting credit card debts at like 20-25%. And that's how they're sustaining themselves, paycheck to paycheck, burying themselves deeper and deeper in debt and getting poorer and poorer. But those closer at the top are able to just get richer and richer because they're able to park the fiat that they're created out of nothing into properties, and they're increasing their wealth. And that's why you get this huge disparities right now, the biggest disparities we've ever seen in any civilization probably. And this is what's creating this tension right now that we see all over the planet. And that's why most of the planet is able to identify the problem easily, that we have inequalities, but the solutions is the problem. And the easy solution that's sold to many people is socialism or communism. And that's what's super dangerous, because that actually makes the problem worse. Socialism is, or communism, is essentially more centralization, and it will lead to more of that. But that's easy sold to people. It's like, oh yeah, it's the richest, the rich is, are at fault, and we just have to tax them. And if we tax the rich, we will get our money back. But that actually makes the problem worse, because if you increase taxes on the rich and make it harder for them and put in place some capital controls on them, the money will just go elsewhere to where it's treated better. So that's why you see countries like right now, probably a good example in the news in the UK, in the United Kingdom, they increased their capital gains tax from, I don't know how much, to from 10 to like 28% or whatever. So what happens is those who have money and are able to work, we're just like, oh, that's what we don't want to stick around for this. I don't want my wealth to be taxed at 28%. I'm leaving. And now the receipts that they're getting for those for that capital gains tax, which was billions a year, has now been halved or something. So because people left the country, then you have some idiots saying, "Oh, but that's a good thing. We don't need rich people. That means there'll be more money for us to go for us to go around for us." Actually, no. It's those people who aspire to be rich are the ones who create the wealth of the country, and those who aspire to be rich are thinking, "I don't want to. If I become rich, I don't want to pay those stupid taxes. I'm going to leave as well." So all of a sudden, you get a drain on the talent in the country as well, and it becomes a vicious cycle. That it's all comes down to the fact that if you put too much capital controls and restrictions on people's private property, that includes your hard-earned money, then you're going to have worse conditions, and you're going to have investments leaving your country, and people are going to end up being poorer.
Mm. I'm seeing it. I mean, I'm in Cyprus, and there's cranes everywhere. There's people moving here from all over the world for those reasons. And this is not the only place in the world that is like that, you know. And it's like people in a little, they're like frogs in a pot, and they're gently turning up that temperature. Because, you know, in the book, the Tao of Bitcoin, he says, as a result of this insidious idea called inflation, we've turned our houses, our homes into hotels, into taxis, and our bodies into porn. And I was like, oh, and it just stopped me in my tracks. And where it's showing up is, you know, we're getting in Australia right now, one of the biggest election issues is the cost of housing. And it, not only are people getting like far less for their money, you know, like $1 million buys you an average house, but that house is on a block of land that's half the size, the build quality's half the quality, right? You know, the rooms are smaller, so you're paying five times what you used to pay, and you're getting half of what you used to get. Your food is getting less nutritious and smaller, and it just creeps into everything slowly, and that's what being at the bottom of the ladder is like. And you just notice you have less time, less money, more pressure, and you have to go further up the risk scale. You can't just work and put your money in the bank. You have to work, put your money in the bank, and then immediately move it into the stock market or into the real estate market. And it's not as simple as just moving it, because when you go up that risk curve, you now have to spend time, which is the one non-renewable resource in your life, learning. Right, you're listening to podcasts, which means you're not sitting there with your spouse, you're not playing with your kids, you're learning about money, because you have to be fiscally responsible. Because what? And that is the question I want listeners to really think about, is really think deeply about, why am I looking at a side hustle? Why am I having to listen to a Bitcoin podcast? What is it that's driving that motivation? And why is that happening? And then the further you scratch that, it's going down that rabbit hole. And that's why a lot of smart people like Philip here and many others end at Bitcoin.
You know, I'm on the other side of the bell curve. I'm under 80 IQ guy. I know the problem, but I don't know how to go into too much detail. But isn't it's true that. Yeah,
you go ahead.
No. What you're saying is what you said about from the DAO of Bitcoin, about how it's turning our homes into hotels and people into prostitutes. And it's so true that, and it also creates, as you said, that because our money is being devalued, constantly being devalued, and you have to find ways of securing your wealth and making sure that it's not devalued, it takes people's time away from actual work and spending time with their families, because they always have to look for someone to put their money into to protect it from the forces of fiat devaluation. And it creates, turns us into all risk takers. And it's just horrible for civilization to grow. Actually, at that point, when that happens, is when civilization starts to fall apart. And you see this many times over, is partly how the Roman Empire and many other civilizations fell apart, is when they started devaluing their money. And we're seeing that right now, is how people are not able to grow families, to have families. And that's what keeps civilization going, is when you actually have birth rates that are replacing or growing populations, you know that you're doing something right, more or less, not always. But right now we're seeing many parts of the West, in the so-called civilized world, in high trust societies even, that birth rates are now below the replacement rate, which is 2.1. In some instances, they're even below one, like in South Korea or Japan. But in most parts of Europe, even in Serbia here as well, it's about 1.4. That means that 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now, our populations will be halved or even less. And it just shows you that civilization is not able to keep up with this devaluation of money. And it's a ticking time bomb, and it's very sad to see. That's also partly to do with not just the financial system, the fiat system, but also with the current governance system of democracies and republics, that we live election to election cycle. And those who are placed in charge are doing what they can to extract as much value from the system for their families and for their connections. And they're promising to in their mandate, in the way that they're voted back in, is that they're promising to dish out higher taxes on certain people, less taxes on certain people, print more money for this program or that program, all these promises. But that just leads to more devaluation and more erosion of private property rights and more capital controls. And over the long run, that just destroys civilizations, that we live in this constant short-term cycles. And it just turns people into reckless risk takers, into building up so much debt at the same time, into partaking in gambling, things like that. And it destroys civilization. People end up losing hope with life and the future. They're so short term. They're living so much day by day that they have no vision they have no long term views. And we, as civilized, as individuals, start to maybe turn to alcohol, drugs, and God knows what. And it's horrible. You see it all over. You see it in the US. You see it there with the opioid crisis. You see it all over the places. And it's very depressing and sad to see. But thankfully, we have hope now, and that comes in now in the shape of a big B, which is Bitcoin.
For those of you that are listening, and this goes a little bit over your head, and you hear us talking about the problem, you're like, but I still don't really understand how Bitcoin's the solution. Don't worry. It is one thing I learn from listening to people like Jeff Booth and Lynn Alden and these absolute epic minds, is that it is a journey, and the key is to remain humble along that way. There are times when I see a comment on YouTube and I just feel like being really rude in response, and then I just kind of remember it takes a long time. Philip and I were talking before we rolled tape, saying, dude, are you the same as me? Like, you jump on, you've been on this journey for 7-8 years, and you still have epiphanies every day of sometimes basic things that you just didn't get until 7 years later. And you've been buying Bitcoin now, and I imagine you've got a decent stack, and I've got a decent stack, and I'm still like, oh my God, I bought before I even understood that fundamental thing. It is a journey, isn't it? It's not, because we're so ingrained and born into this system that it takes so long for us to actually reverse our brain out and to understand that one Bitcoin will always be one Bitcoin. It will never be less. Yeah. It just takes time to rewire.
I wish I had a bigger stack though. I mean, that's the thing. Once you understand about Bitcoin, then you spend all your time wanting to build your stack. And that's an important thing, is that hoarding is also a thing that we've been taught that it's a bad thing. Yes, maybe hoarding in the fiat system is bad. I mean, it's unadvisable. You can't really hoard fiat cash. You don't really have massive amounts of cash, hoarding cash, because that's just silly on an investment perspective. But in a Bitcoin standard, in a hard money standard, actually hoarding, saving a lot of money, is actually beneficial for the system. because it allows you to have more of a long-term vision. It lowers your time preference, and it means that you're more secured for the future, and you know that you can supply, you can provide for your family. But it also, it has ripple effects for your community as well, that you're able then to reinvest in that, because you can't just live by yourself. Yeah, you can homestead to a certain degree, but if you want to live in a good society, you're going to have to give back to the society. And this is where, if you have a good amount of cash, hoarding cash, then you're able to reinvest that money back into the community, into projects, into businesses, and that just grows civilization. But that can only be possible if it, under a hard money standard, under a Bitcoin standard, under a potential, what was a gold standard. And this is what's important, is that hoarding gives people, also increases those people who don't have much cash, who don't have much money, or also they benefit from your hoarding as well, because you're actually giving back that hoarding. You are actually sustaining the community as well. It's those people who don't have much cash will actually start to, their time preferences will start to lower as well, because they will start to see the benefits of your work as well. So it has a knock-on effects. That's a hard money standard rewards those who work the hardest, but those who don't work that hard, who aren't, or for some different reasons, are actually benefited as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it makes people into a better human when you start accumulating Bitcoin and you truly understand its value and where we are in the journey. Like you said, you stop when you personally start thinking on a Bitcoin standard. You stop spending money on useless crap, and you just go, I'm not going to exchange. Like, I was walking down the street here in Limassol the other day, and we walked past this shop front. It was just full of just crap, right? And I said to my wife, I just can't imagine going into that store and buying literally anything and going, I'm going to trade my time for that. Whereas when you've got fiat money, you're used to just spending it, because that is the smart thing to do. You're incentivized to get rid of it as quickly as possible. The problem is most people get rid of it into non-hard assets, but you're incentivized to get rid of it because we all know it's becoming worth less and less. So get rid of it, use it, right? Whereas in Bitcoin, it's the inverse. And to accumulate, you start to think and you start to act like somebody who actually builds wealth, because the money that you are basing your life in is sound and has historically gone up year after year, you know, if you zoom out over time.
Exactly. And it teaches you to spend money only the things that you really need. Yeah, you can splash out here and there for some luxuries, but in general, you become more conscious of where your money is going and how you spend your money.
Do I need these pair of shoes, or do I buy some Satoshis? And all of a sudden you go, the shoes can wait. I'm just
Exactly.
It's such a flip on like what our whole life we've worked for money that's becoming less and less valuable over time. And this is why it takes so long to just rewire the brain.
It really does humble you in that respect. That's you see a lot of people out there just they say, oh, I can't afford Bitcoin because you know, it's life is expensive and stuff. And then they go buy a €6 cup of coffee, right, or they grab the latest iPhone, or they're spending €1,000 on a car repayment. It's like, do you really need that BMW? No, I mean, I'm a prince, but I drive a shitty little Opel, you know. Exactly. Why? Because I don't need anything else. I mean, okay, I would like to have a bigger car because my family's growing, but I'm in no rush. I get by with what we have. So
I love it. Yeah. Man, you're so refreshing to talk to, and I can't believe I'm talking to an heir to be a king, but it's just so refreshing.
It gives me
hopes about the future.
If the monarchy returns, but that's what we're doing is I'm really have a long-term view on this, and I would really hope that monarchy does return here. I think monarchy will do a lot of good for this country again. I think monarchies will do a lot of good for a lot of countries. It's a system that it's very misunderstood. And the reasons why it was abolished in such a big way in the late 19th century and early 20th century was because of the incentive structures of what an absolute monarchy can actually do. And you can actually see the proof in the pudding right now in places like in the Middle East, where you see the most, the wealthier Middle East countries are all absolute, well, monarchies. Some of them are not absolute, some of them are semi-absolute or semi-constitutional, but the wealthier countries tend to be monarchies. Yes, you have some anomalies like Israel, but that's not, I mean, that's not a Muslim country. It's a bit different. But if you look at the wealthy countries in the Middle East, you have Qatar, you have Oman, Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and they all have one thing in common, that they're monarchies. Then you look at Iraq, you look at Syria, you look at Yemen, you look at...
What do you think the reason is? The spiritual value system?
So as opposed to a democracy and a monarchy, let's say that it's in an absolute monarchy, I'm going to talk about it in this purest sense, is that the monarch essentially owns the country, owns the government. And his incentivize is to make sure that his heirs, his hereditary line, so his children's children are in that position for many, many years to come. And in order to do that, he has to make sure that he does not take any sort of stupid, fleeting decisions. And he has to make sure that he makes the right choices, because if he makes a bad decision, then that could wipe out his line. So this means things like private property, like under an absolute monarchy, that chances are that it's going to have very strong private property rights. Because if you take too much from the public, from your people today, then there's going to be a revolution and you'll be overthrown. So you have to take as little as possible and leave as much as you can for your generations, for the generations to come. So that's why if you go to the countries that I mentioned, for example, they have very, very low taxation. Look at Dubai, for example. Look at the United Arab Emirates. I mean, the place is expanding, bustling, and loads of people moving there. Why? Because they have some of the lowest taxes in the world. Same thing in Qatar and Oman, Bahrain, all those countries. Then if you compare that to democracies, to republicanism, is what we talked about before, is that they have every 4 or 5 years, they have an election cycle. And when the new government or government comes in, they're essentially just caretakers of that government. And they're incentivized just to take as much as they can for their families and their people. Yeah, of course, there's that I'm being kind of harsh in that respect, but you see that they do what they can to stay in power. And in order to do what they can to stay in power, they become very short-termism. Their time preference is quite low. And they end up doing stupid things like raising taxes in certain segments of the population, end up printing money to fund XY so-and-so product, whatever. And this has effects on the economy. And this is then, if they make a bad decision, it's okay. They just step down and someone new just steps in. And
no accountability.
There's no accountability and stuff. So they end up, you know, society just ends up crumbling that way. Mm. Monarchy is not perfect, but it's like the lesser of two evils against democracies. And obviously, I'd say the step after monarchy, it would be as if we all lived under a natural order. And that's when you have minimal state at all. And I think monarchies would actually do a lot of good if they were backed by under a Bitcoin standard, because that will then stop the monarch from having any access to printing money. And in that respect, the monarch just becomes the protector of traditions, customs, but also of law. But he is also subject to the law as well. He is not above the law. He is literally just the protector of the continuation of the stability of the country. And
I would have said 10 years ago this argument would be just shot down in flames, but I can tell you that now I speak to so many Australians right now and they are completely disillusioned with the democratic choices that we have in that country. We have two guys running for office from, you know, imperceptibly narrow differences in who they are and their values and whatever, because it's a populist voting system, right? So they're both just offering what they think the population wants.
Exactly.
People are super disillusioned, but they're also super disillusioned with, this watering down of values, this, tradition and customs of Australia are gone. Modern Australia is just being disintegrated. I think there's a lot of people out there now, and you can probably see it with the Trump campaign, you know, it's a populist ideals and so on, but we see in also in a lot of Muslim countries there's a boom in it because they're not watering down their heritage. They're not watering down a lot of those things. And right. people are wanting that. People are wanting certainty. They're wanting to maintain custom. So it's a really interesting time on the planet. We're running out of time. I want to finish just by asking a couple of things about Jan 3 and your role there.
Sure, sure.
You work with Samson Mao, who I love, Samson. He's got such good vibes and good energy. I'd love to hear about why you joined Jan 3. And also, I saw in the press that you sort of believe that Bitcoin has been a victim of price suppression. Like there are people who are incentivized in the old system or actors in the current system that are incentivized to depress the price of Bitcoin. So maybe you could speak to that and why you joined Jan 3 and what you're doing there and just that sort of stuff and where you guys think it's heading.
A lot of questions. I'll start. Yeah, joined Jan 3. That was in 2022, just after I went public on Bitcoin on that talk show. You probably saw the clip. Next thing I know, I was invited to podcast. I went on to Safety and the Moose's podcast. I went on Daniel Prince's podcast. That was the first ever podcast I did. And big kudos to Dan Prince, because he was the one who took me under his wing and introduced me to a lot of good Bitcoiners. Next thing we know, ended up in Miami, and he introduced me to Samson Mao. And Samson Mao just started Jan 3. And for those who don't know who Jan 3 is, Samson Mao used to work at Blockstream. It's a big executive there at Blockstream. Blockstream is a company headed by Adam Back. Adam Back was mentioned in the white paper. He's a legend in the cyberpunk world. But then Samson left Blockstream to start Jan 3 as the time when nation state adoption became a big topic, when El Salvador adopted Bitcoin. Samson was with Bukele talking to him about volcano bonds, about Bitcoin-backed bonds. And he was on stage and announced that El Salvador would release those bonds. Still yet to be released, but that's flicked a switch in Samson's head to realize, actually, you know, there's going to be a niche, a movement of nation states wanting to adopt Bitcoin. You know, he understood that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't need politicians, but politicians will probably end up needing Bitcoin. And this is a good way to market Bitcoin across the world, because Bitcoin does not have a marketing team. Bitcoin does not have any CEOs or any employees. It's a completely decentralized commodity, so to speak. But we can do what we can to try and market it, Bitcoin, around the world. We can leverage politicians, you know, presidents, prime ministers, ministers, kings, queens, you know, you name it. If we get pictures with them, with Bitcoiners and them talking about Bitcoin, that's one way to move Bitcoin forward. And so he started Jan 3, which is a company that helps to speed up, that's facilitating the speeding up of hyper-Bitcoinization. And when we say hyper-Bitcoinization, that is the endpoint of Bitcoin when the whole world or regions, countries, jurisdictions move on to a Bitcoin standard, because all money will tend to one. And he also saw that was the strategy of Jan 3. It's top down strategy, but Bitcoin is a bottom up strategy. It's a grassroots effort. It's decentralization at its pure, at its finest. But he also created the wallet called Aqua Wallet, which he started in Blockstream. But when he was allowed to take it away from Blockstream, him and Adam Back are very good friends still. Adam Back is an advisor to Jan 3. And Samson saw that in order to orange pill the next, to bank the unbanked, the next billion people, he saw that USDT could be a key to that, because USDT for the viewers who don't know is US dollar acting as a crypto, so to speak, and it's called USDT Tether because it's tethered to the dollar. One USDT is equal to $1, more or less. And in Latin America is very big with Bitcoin and crypto, but they actually transact more in USDT than they do with Bitcoin. A lot of people in Latin America use USDT and don't really understand what Bitcoin is. So that already sends off some light bulbs, like thinking, oh, that's a good way to get some people on board. So how do you do that? How do you get these people to use Bitcoin as well? So Samson created a wallet where which is called Aqua Wallet, where you have your savings account. So in the face of the wallet, you have on the top line, it says savings account, and that's Bitcoin on the main chain. And then you have your spending accounts, plural. One of them is Bitcoin Liquid, and that is Liquid is a sidechain, Bitcoin layer two sidechain for quicker, more private transactions. And you're able to move your Bitcoin from the main chain onto hold it onto Bitcoin Liquid. And that will then also, you can spend that with Lightning. It will opens up Lightning channels. And below that, you'll have USDT. And the importance of that is USDT, it's on Liquid, because USDT can function on many other shitcoin rails like Ethereum, ERC20, Tron, and so forth. And we want them to be using just Bitcoin, USDT, on just Bitcoin Liquid. So when you transfer from USDT from any other site, from any other shitcoin rail onto our wallet, it will come up as working on Bitcoin Liquid. And that's your spending account. So it's a Bitcoin-centric wallet that you can use USDT, but also everything Bitcoin in there. And it means that those people in Latin America, for example, where USDT is used a lot, are able to use USDT, but then they will see the savings account and realize, oh, what's that? You know, that's Bitcoin savings account. Okay, maybe I should transfer some of my USDT onto that savings account. And they will see their savings grow and grow. So it's a way of orange pilling people. And it's a very easy to use wallet. As we said, on when you open up the wallet, sometimes you'll see it says a wallet your grandmother can use. We're trying to make the user experience as easy and as friendly as possible. When I talk about it right now, it sounds quite complex, but when you actually have the product in your hand, it's really straightforward.
And have you got a minute for me just to talk about this? Are you okay?
Because there's
a lot here, and I think it's important to understand the importance of what you're just explaining here with this product. Samson's a legend in the space, and so I want people just to have that background. Adam, actually, I hung out with Adam at the Louvre in Paris just recently at Blockchain Week. I got to meet him. Such a legend of a dude, so low key. But anyway, let's get back to your wallet here, and I want people to understand this in a simple term. So in Latin America, they have money, inflation problems, so they get their paid in their lira or whatever it is they get, and then they go to an exchange and they buy USDT. So they're basically exchanging their currency for US dollar equivalent, correct?
Well, yes. Also, people, when they like to get paid there, they like to get paid in dollars. And quite often they want cash, but cash is hard to come by, or they don't get the actual digital dollar. But the next best thing is USDT. So they want dollar exposure. Dollar is still king in Latin America.
So Tether is a private company. And when you go and buy a Tether token, they go and buy a US Treasury. So they actually are backed by US dollars, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yes. So it's not just this private company Tether just printing off tokens. They actually are then, when the dollar comes in, they're buying a US Treasury so that they actually hold real, you know, dollar backed. You know, there's an argument about what the dollar's actually worth, but it is a real US dollar. So they are converting their lira or whatever it is that they've got, peso, into a digital version of the US dollar. And what you've just explained, Philip, if I understand it correctly, and you can correct me at the end, is just like when we open our wallet here. In my wallet, I've got, you know, this is my physical wallet. I've got a whole bunch of credit cards in here, right? I've got Amex, I've got a NAB, I've got a Wise card, all this. You've got a digital wallet that's on a phone, I assume, for these people. And in that wallet, they've got, like, it's just like opening up a bank account or opening up your physical wallet. There's a Bitcoin line, which is actual Bitcoin I own.
That's called the savings account line,
Savings account line. The problem is that the Bitcoin network, you know, the transaction fees and the time doesn't necessarily make sense if I want to go downstairs and buy a pint to pay in Bitcoin, because it might take 10 minutes for the transaction to be confirmed. They might not, you know, actually have any way of processing a Bitcoin. So you sweep some of those funds into the next line, which is your spendings account. So you've got a savings account, your spendings account, and that's operating on a technology called the Lightning Network, for people who don't know what that means.
Liquid and Lightning.
Liquid and Lightning, okay. So I can then go and just pay for whatever I want from funds that have been swept into that everyday spendings account. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and the transaction goes straight away.
And under that Liquid or Lightning line, you have USDT, which is spending account. And we have a marketplace, so we're able to swap between one to another. That's where we pick up fees, revenue fees. But otherwise, we make it as easy as possible. And that marketplace is also what we want to make Aqua into the super app, into a killer app, super app. And we want to offer as many services as possible, so you don't never have to use a bank. So we want to start. We're going to start debit cards. We'll be able to pay your bills there as well. You'll be able to.
The bankless, basically. People who can't get access to, like, people don't realize there's huge swathes of humanity that don't have a bank account, whereas they can get a Jan 3 wallet and
you can buy and sell Bitcoin as well, and transact between one Bitcoin to Liquid to USDT and back and forth. As I said, the debit card and as well, we'll be able to starting to be able to pay bills and utilities and stuff like that. And all doing this while being non-custodial as well, mean that you are in charge of your funds, that we won't rely on a bank at all. So you can do it. You'll be completely self-sovereign.
Is it only people in emerging countries that would use this, or people in the West as well?
We're trying to release it all over the world. Of course, the biggest focus right now is Latin America, given its exposure, its demand for US dollars. I mean, there's demand for US dollars all over the world, but especially in Latin America, and also their understanding of crypto in general. They get it a bit more than other countries. But Africa is going to be big, Asia, all over Europe, anywhere really. We're going to offer the services everywhere. So that's why it's going to be a super app.
And you're the CSO, Chief Strategy Officer, with Ryan around the world. And maybe you could just talk quickly just at the end here about what Samson's got some pretty ambitious price targets for Bitcoin. Maybe you could share what they are. And then also the reasons that we have not really, some people go, the Bitcoin bull run is over. I'm of the opinion that it's not really even started yet. I feel like it's only up a little bit from its last all-time high. I feel that we're coming into a very strong period. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Like, what's your thesis for who's suppressing the price and why? And where do you think it could go in the next five years?
Well, I mean, it could. Samson talks about the Omega candle. He's talking about one day, anyone from tomorrow to the next few years, there's going to be a huge green candle that's going to take off, and it's going to melt faces, and it's going to surprise us all. And why? Because his main thesis is because it's of a supply crunch, that there's not enough Bitcoin to go around to buy to get everyone at a cheap price, that all of a sudden, just simple economics is going to take over. When there's going to be more demand than there is supply, the price is just going to skyrocket. But why hasn't that happened right now? I'm under the impression that there is some manipulations in the market, because Bitcoin you can't control the market. You can't control the market, Bitcoin. It's completely uncontrollable. No matter how many regulations you throw at Bitcoin, it's going to do what it wants to do. And there's going to be a lot of people trying to suppress the price. They want to stack Bitcoin at its cheapest price possible, because they know that it's going to be that one day the supply crunch is going to just make it take off. So I'm thinking that there's a lot of big players out there right now who are just waking up to what Bitcoin is, and waking up to how the financial system is going to fail at some point. Trying to buy as much Bitcoin as possible. So they'd see, I mean, there's only a certain amount of time before they won't be able to control the market so easily. It's just simple economics.
It's the only truly hard asset in the history of humanity. It's the only thing we can't grow more of, make more of. Like, it's programmatically set. And I find it interesting seeing, gamification. What is that the right word? Play out now with between nation states, but also big corporate entities. I watched with interest the announcement last week of the new company 21, headed up by Jack Mahler's, but backed by Howard Lutnick's firm, who is the head of treasury in the US government, as well as SoftBank. And they're going to seed that company with 42,000 Bitcoin. and basically emulate Michael Saylor's strategy. And Michael Saylor bought up the next 3 years of supply himself as one entity. So when you start looking at this, you know, world where you have a finite global asset that people from all over the world can buy, sell, trade 24/7 from anywhere, and you start seeing significant capital allocators coming to the market like that, and then you see governments, you know, waking up to the fact. And I think when you look at the White House right now, and you look at the Bitcoin is in there, like 70% of JD Vance's wealth is in Bitcoin. The same with RFK. Lutnick owns, I think, billions of dollars of Bitcoin. So you've got this really interesting setup right now. Are you guys sort of seeing and the same thing?
Game theory is going to...
Game theory, that's the word. That's, very interesting. On multiple layers.
From corporate layer to the sovereign layer to governments, the nation states. And that's what we're trying to... Gen 3 is trying to boost is nation state adoption. We don't see that nation states have to own Bitcoin, but we see them, like, they can be useful in getting other people and individuals around the world waking up to Bitcoin, because nation states, presidents, governments still hold some credibility around the world. So if they get talking about Bitcoin, if they're pictured with Bitcoin, as if they're talking about Bitcoin, that's going to get people questioning it and talking about it, and then actually getting their hands on some as well. And we're just trying to speed up the process of people understanding what Bitcoin is, so we can save them financially, and so they become financially sovereign, independent. That's the key, is to bank the unbanked. And that's where we work on advising governments around the world, but also we provide the tools for individuals to get onto Bitcoin. And that's why Aqua Wallet comes in. But also we also have an OTC where we buy and sell Bitcoin for wealthy individuals and stuff. And there's a lot of volume happening there as well. And we want to start doing mining projects and so forth. We're just trying to, because we're a Bitcoin technology company, we're still a startup. You know, we just finished our seed round, so we're at the very beginning stages. But we have a very long view, very long term view. And there's a lot of exciting projects that they're going to be working on, and hopefully exciting announcements in the future.
Philip, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate your perspective and you coming and talking to me and our audience. If this has been interesting to you as a viewer, please drop a comment, like, subscribe, let us know if you're enjoying this content, if it's landing. I would just encourage you, if you feel like this is over your head, don't become discouraged. There's parts, I'm even right at the end there with OTC and these words you've probably never heard before. Don't worry. It's a journey, and start where you are. And the first step is to buy the Bitcoin standard. And when you're ready, buy a little bit of Bitcoin so you understand how to buy it and how to put it into a cold storage wallet, like Philip talked about. And start by doing the steps and listening to more podcasts. And then in time, your knowledge will grow. And all I can say is it's been a wonderful journey for me. And I think you can detect from Philip here, it's been a wonderful discovery for him as well. And we'd love to sort of join you on that journey. Philip, thank you for your time. I wish you every success with Gen 3. We look forward to having Samson on at some point in the future as well, having a chat with him. And just one thing I wanted to say is that for viewers listening to this, the day you buy Bitcoin is the day that people like Philip and Samson and Michael Saylor and all that work for you, because they're out there advocating for the asset, right? And isn't that a wonderful asset to be a part of? And that's why we all do what we do, is we advocate for the network, which in all of our view is still seriously undervalued at the price it is today, because the global asset pool is close to 900 trillion and Bitcoin is under 2 trillion of that. But when the fire alarms go off and the smoke starts filling the cinema, as Larry Lepard says, they're going to be running for the exits, and this is where you're going to see those Omega candle moves, is our opinion. It's not financial advice, but Omega candle moves means that you'll see it go from where it is today in $10,000, $100,000 leaps, because you have a fixed supply and people need oxygen. And when it happens, like on Swan Bitcoin, they always say slowly, slowly, then all at once. And that's, I think, what we're going to witness in our lifetime, which is going to be an interesting, challenging time. But if you hold Bitcoin, I think you're going to be in a much better place.
Adam, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip. Thanks for being here.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.